specializing to half filling. Remember, half filling is one electron per site on the average. So Ni equal to one, I put it on the average. And also large U. So the Hubbard model has two terms, as we said. Hopping term on all nearest neighbor bonds, Ci, Cj, where Hoppe spin, or an electron with a spin from site I to site J, or from site J to site I. Of course, I need both terms in order for the Hamiltonian to be Hermitian. This is the hopping term that gives us the band structure, tight binding band structure, if it were the only term. And then there's the interaction term, which now I'm going to write as U over 2, sum over I, Ni minus 1 squared. So I would write it different ways every time. If I wrote just Ni squared, the difference is that I have here another term of order Ni, but Ni is also the sum of Ni is what comes into the chemical potential. Here, I don't want to write the chemical potential. I want it to be automatically such that you can see that this Hamiltonian is at half filling, because if I take U to be large, this term will vanish only when Ni will be close to 1, and that makes sure that at large U, this is at half filling. Now, this happens to be at half filling even for small U, because this term here is particle Hall symmetric. Anyway, it has a symmetry that ensures that it's not moving the density away from half filling. But this is the Hamiltonian I want to study, and I want to study it in the regime where large U over T. That's the regime where the interactions dominate. And if I want to separate the Hamiltonian, like we did last time, into H0 and V, I will actually pick this part to be H0 and this part to be my perturbation V. Why do I want to do that? I'm interested in what happens at large U when the system wants to have very closely to one electron per site. That electron can have either spin up or spin down. And I want to see, how can I simplify this Hamiltonian and write an effective Hamiltonian in the low energy subspace that is essentially the Heisenberg model, that's what we're going to get, to describe the low energy spin fluctuations of this model. So this model has been studied in one and two dimensions quite a lot. I'll just tell you some very brief background. In one dimension, there's an exact solution by Bethe-Ansatz. It's a complicated solution. I'm not going to teach one dimension. I'm not going to teach the Bethe-Ansatz solution. But in general, this model describes, in one dimension, two different phases. One of them is a phase where the density is different than 1, and then it's essentially a Luttinger liquid. It's a kind of a metal with strong interactions. It's conducting, but it has strong interactions. And the other regime is exactly when n is equal to 1, and then it turns into, essentially with the same transformation we're going into today, the spin a half Heisenberg model in one dimension, which again has a Bethe-Ansatz solution. And both the doped case, when n is different than 1 and when n is equal to 1, are completely known. The correlations are known. People study it when they study one-dimensional problems, one-dimensional metals, one-dimensional conductors. In two dimensions, this is an open problem, except at half filling, which is where we're interested, when n is equal to 1, and this will map into a spin model called the Heisenberg model. If n is different than 1, then the model becomes more complicated. It's called a TJ model. That's the model people study in the context of high-temperature superconductors, those who went to the colloquium yesterday. How many of you went to the colloquium? Oh, okay. You probably heard the words Hubbard model, Heisenberg model quite a lot. Maybe one of the things to pick up from the colloquium was that this problem is complicated. Okay, so there's been quite a lot of progress in understanding what's going on, but it's not the subject I want to talk about here. So I'm not going to talk about n different than 1, just n equal to 1. So at n equal to 1, and at large u, if I look at h0, I know its spectrum exactly. It's very simple. The spectrum, essentially, of this Hamiltonian is very simple. At every site I, there are 3 states. Well, actually, there's 4 states. There's 2 states of n equal 1, spin up and spin down, and they have energy 0. And then there's an empty state, n equal to 0. That's marked by circle. That state has energy u over 2. And then there's another state of the same energy, which is when there's 2 electrons. So this is a kind of an atomic physics description of the problem. 2 states at 0, 2 states at u over 2. Now, I said u is a large number. So this is a large gap. Large compared to something. Large compared to t. So this term here is a term that wants to take a spin and hop it. But notice what happens. If I take this spin and the neighboring site is here, and it has also a spin there, I can't hop it and stay at low energy. Because if I hop it onto a next spin and there's already an electron there, if the electron is in the same direction, it won't hop because of the Pauli principle. If it's in the other direction, it can join him, but then it will jump up by an energy u over 2. So that is a gap to transport, a gap to charge fluctuations, a gap that makes this at large u over t a Mott insulator. So Mott, Sir Nival Mott, got the Nobel Prize with Anderson on essentially describing insulators in semiconductors that are built on this effect that electrons get localized by impurities and interactions. And once they get localized, the energy to put another electron on top of the first one costs so much that you can't move the electrons. And if you can't move them, it's an insulator. Yeah. There are no electrons. Ni equals 0. This is Ni equal to 2. And these two are Ni equal 1. Okay? It's the simplest spectrum you can think of. And this is this term. So this term we know how to diagonalize very easily. So in the real space basis, in this particular case, the interactions are easily diagonalizable. But of course, that's not the basis that will help us diagonalize this term. So what we're going to do is we're going to do this projection to a low Hilbert space because we have here essentially a definition of 2 subspaces of the Hilbert space. The subspace of n equal 1 and the subspace of n equal 0 and 2. So I'm going to split my Hilbert space as I did last lecture, but then I did it abstractly. Now I'm going to separate my Hilbert space to all the states where every site is occupied by exactly 1 electron. That space has actually 0 energy because this term vanishes on n. And then all the rest. The rest will include double occupations, 1 double occupied, 2 double occupied, 3 double occupied, and so on. And these will cost energy of order u, 2u, 3u, and so on. So I'll define these projectors, P of lambda that we did last time, and then I'll find out how to replace this Hamiltonian with an effective Hamiltonian that actually lives in the lower Hilbert space. So let me describe the projectors in the Hilbert space. Very simple. So my P of lambda is now PS for singly occupied state. Project onto the Hilbert space, which is defined by states. These are actually a Fock representation of the space, where I have spin S, 1, S, 2, S, N, where S, I can get the value plus or minus a half H bar. The space here is size 2 to the n. That's smaller than the full Hilbert space, because the full Hilbert space is 4 to the n. There's 4 states per site, right? 2 singly occupied, and then 1, 0, and 1 doubly occupied. But here, I'm cutting down with this projector to 2 to the n. And then the rest, 1 minus ps, which is all states n, I, s. So n I, let's write it, n I up, n 2 down, n 1 down, n 2 up, n 2 down, n I s. That's a way of writing this state also, where at least exists an I for n I is equal to 2. Of course, if the total number of electrons is exactly equal to the number of sites, if ni equal to 1 on the whole, then if I have a double occupied site somewhere else I have a zero occupied site because I took an electron from somewhere. But in principle, exists an I that ni is equal to 2 is enough to define this space. And this space is the complementary to this space. Okay, here exactly all I and I equal to 1. So these are my two Hilbert spaces. Now let's look at the Hamiltonian H0, which is my U. U over 2, that's H0. U over 2 and I minus 1 squared. When I look at the lower projected Hilbert space, PS, H0 PS is equal to, what is it equal to? If I project the Hamiltonian, this one, to this space, what energies do I get? What's the energy of
single occupied sets? These are the single occupied sets. What is the energy of the zero? Okay? There's no matrix elements of the Hamiltonian in this projected state because this term vanishes on it.
Okay? Let's check what happens to PS and the kinetic term. The kinetic term here, call it T. PST, PS. That is the expectation value of the Hopping matrix element in the lower space of single electrons. So all I have to do is think about a state, this state, for instance, or maybe I'll take a concrete example. Let's say a state like this. Site 1, site 2, site 3, site 4, site 5. This is a state that belongs to the projected PS. And what the Hamiltonian wants to do, the T part, it wants to take an electron from, let's say, 2 and hop it to 3. But once I hop an electron from 2 to 3, I get out of my space, right? There's double occupation here, 0 here. I go from PS to 1 over 1 minus PS. I go from this subspace to the complementary one. So if I do PS, T, PS, I must get also what? Also 0, right? Because I can't hop an electron and stay in the same space. This is unique to half-filling. If I had holes in the problem, if I wasn't at half filling, if some of my spins were not there, let's say here I had a hole, so this is n different than 1 on the average, then I can take this electron and hop it to here and still stay in the lower subspace, and this term won't vanish. But at half filling, this has to vanish. So I'm just hinting here that once you dope away from half filling, there is a T term. There is a kinetic energy term that survives large U. But here we're interested just in half filling, and this is 0. So what I got is that in my effective Hamiltonian expression, if you remember it, I'll write it again. The effective Hamiltonian expression was given by the projector H0 plus. So now I'll write it actually in terms of the operators U and V, U plus U and T, PS. That's my H0 plus V from before, right? Plus sum over N goes from 1 to infinity. I'm writing the full Boolean-Wigner expansion. I have here the projection P, S, T. T is off diagonal. T can connect me between PS and 1 minus PS. And also inside PS, at 1 minus PS, it can connect me between 2 double-occupied sites and 2 double-occupied sites because it keeps moving electrons around and piling them on top of each other. So T is off diagonal and connects me. And now I have here this expression, 1 minus PS times T divided by E minus U. I can also write 1 minus PS here to make sure that this operator is well defined. And I take all this guy, raise it to the power n. So when you look at this expression, and you say, how much can you do with it? Well, as I said before, all we need here is second order perturbation theory. At second order perturbation theory, we'll just keep E to be E0. Why? Because I'm doing it to second order in T, and E has corrections of higher order in T. So if E has a correction of order T, let's say, or T squared, then that will add to this higher order in T corrections. So I'll replace, first of all, this is 0 by construction. And I'll write E to second order is equal to PS T 1 minus PS T PS. And this is divided by E minus E0 minus U as an operator. Okay. So this is the simplified expression, and the correction here is of order T cubed and higher. It's still not clear here what is the small parameter because I'm writing operators. And in order to justify an asymptotic expansion, I need numbers. But once you evaluate this, you'll get the small parameter. The small parameter will be essentially the size of T, which is the small t, and the energy gap between the ground state and the energy of the term U in the double-occupied sector, which is U. So this will be essentially minus U here. This will be T squared. So you'll have a small parameter, which is T divided by U. And so I know already that these terms here, without doing much calculation, are going to be of order T cubed over U squared. And I'll neglect them for T less than U. So the job I still have to do is to write this in terms of second quantized operators from the Hubbard model. Just evaluate this expression, that's all. Now, This term here is exactly the same as you get from Rayleigh-Schrödinger perturbation theory when you evaluate the second order correction to the energy in degenerate perturbation theory, right? Because what essentially is happening is if I didn't put this term in, there'll be a huge degeneracy in H because there's no linear term. I threw away a linear term here. So my Hamiltonian is essentially 0, 0, 0, 0 on the 2 to the n basis. Remember, this is 2 to the n times 2 to the n matrix or operator. So it's highly degenerate. What lifts the degeneracy is this term. So this is second order degenerate perturbation theory as you would get from Rayleigh-Schrödinger. In Rayleigh-Schrödinger, you have here the energy itself, but the corrections of order t cubed will look different than the term here that I get of order t cubed because of this changing in the energy. So why did I go through all the brilliant Wigner if I'm only keeping second order? I wanted to teach something a bit more general about renormalization, because in this particular case, it's very simple to renormalize because we have, in our U model, we have 2 to the n states of singly occupied, and then we have a gap of order U to 1 double 1 whole, let's say something like that, and then we have another energy over U for 2 holes and 2 doubles, and it's very simple to find where to put lambda, where to put the cutoff in order to do renormalization. Put it here. Okay, just keep all the states in this degenerate manifold. So that's a natural problem for renormalization when you have a huge gap and all the things above the gap you're not interested in, and you get an effective Hamiltonian that lives in this space. And it's enough to do one step RG, one step renormalization, get the effective Hamiltonian. In many cases, that's not the situation. In many cases, you have a spectrum that has no particular gap, but you still want to simplify and find the low energy. So what you do is do a running lambda. You pick some lambda somewhere. You do the operation, get the effective Hamiltonian to second order, and find an effective Hamiltonian H effective. But H effective depends on lambda. Now, you look at this H effective, and it has new coupling constants. Instead of, let's say, T and U, it has T prime, U prime, and maybe other things. So those will depend on lambda. Now you can do it again, exactly the same procedure I did before, and find the lambda prime and derive H effective lambda prime. When you do that sequentially, it's called renormalization group. You apply the renormalization as a transformation, and transformations behave like a group. So when you do it sequentially, you get a method where you move from H lambda to H lambda prime. That movement of H lambda to H lambda prime is associated in some certain cases with differential equations. Then you solve the differential equations, and that's called solving the renormalization group flow and finding the H effective of lambda goes to zero. This is RG in condensed matter. There's another RG in high energy physics where they do the opposite thing. They take lambda to infinity, and that's called looking at the ultraviolet renormalization. Here it's the infrared renormalization. But basically, the idea is the same. You move from Hamiltonian to Hamiltonian until eventually you end up with a simple one, and that gives you the solution. So I'm not going out doing RG in this course, but since this is a one-step RG, I thought to put it in a more general framework because you're going to see it again in contexts more like critical phenomena and phase transitions and so on. So, but we're not, as I say, iterating anything here. We're just doing it once. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
Here, the H2 is derived from n equals 1.
Yes.
In interacting models, okay, one of the main goals that people want to understand is the ground state. Ground state means taking essentially only the lowest lying state and knowing its properties. So, and it's not just the ground state, the low temperature, the low lying excitations. To get the low lying excitations of a thermodynamic system, you really don't need to keep the cutoff high. You can take the cutoff to be very, very low and still have an effect on Hamiltonian to give you the low temperature, low frequency, and the long wavelength properties correctly. That's why I take lambda to be small. The idea is that sometimes situations simplify. Sometimes the structure of the low energy physics can be described by an effective model with very few parameters that you can actually solve alternatively, or that you can immediately read the solution from the model itself. While the original model could be complicated with millions of parameters, and you have no handle on what it does. So this is essentially the philosophy behind denormalization. I'm interested in the low energy part. So for instance, in the Heisenberg model, but if you take a metal like, I don't know, nickel oxide or copper oxides, which are described quite well by Hubble model, then at quite reasonable temperatures, already room temperature, the charge fluctuations are already frozen out. U is of order electron volts, so that's thousands of degrees. So at room temperature, really, there's no charge fluctuations. And all the dynamics of the problem become spin fluctuations. So you don't really need to go to very low temperatures to already be in the regime where the effective electron is important. And that's why, but sometimes you really have to go to low temperatures to get there. But anyways, that depends on the gaps and the sizes of interactions. Okay, so I'm going to do this calculation. Heisenberg model out of it. So it's not a difficult one, it's just a little bit of
algebra. So before that, I need to define spin half operators. I'm sure you've seen it, and also in the exercise. The operator that counts my z direction of the spin is a half ni up minus ni down. The operator that this is at site I, the operator of s plus is c up dagger c down, and s minus I is c dagger down c up. These are the three spin operators, and of course s plus is sx plus isy plus minus, okay? So once I've got those down, I essentially want to write the operators I'm going to get here in terms of these kinds of operators. So my H2 is given in terms of sum of ij minus t cis cjs. That's my cjs cis. That's my Hopping term, times a projector onto double occupied site, 1 minus ps. And then there's another time I write jk minus t cj ck plus ck cj s prime s prime s prime s prime. And this E0, but E0 we know is zero, right? Because the lower subspace has zero energy. So I just have the minus U times essentially the energy of the states I will get after applying T, and sum over n I minus 1 squared. So that's the energy I'm going to get. Now I know that ni is going to be different than 1 here because it's the complementary to the single occupied states. But in order to see which terms, there's lots of terms here, which terms actually survive, here I have a projector onto the single occupied, here I have a projector to the single occupied, I have to think what these terms are doing. So this term is taking, let's say, an electron from site K, putting it on site J. Putting it on site J, and here I force site J is already occupied, so therefore, when I put it on site J, the energy here of U will be exactly 1, because I'll have here Ni equal to 2, 2 minus 1, it's 1, so I'll get minus U. So this term will be very simple, but it's just 1 over minus U, and I'll hop an electron from K to J. With site, let's say S, and here there'll be double occupied sites. So you see I'm drawing these diagrams to show which terms survive. I'm taking this term, I'm getting a factor of minus T, I'm getting a factor of minus U, and then I have another term, but that term is supposed to bring me back to single occupied sites. So even though this guy can hop any electron on the lattice to any other neighbor, it's not going to bring me back to the single occupied sites unless it takes away an electron from the double occupied and puts it back where it took it from K. So this ensures that JK will be acted on by a term which is exactly KJ, because I need to take this double occupied at J and move it back to K. Now, not necessarily I'm going to move back the same electron I got. I could move back the same electron, or I can move back an electron in opposite spin. There's a sum over two spins here. I always forget the sum, and here's S prime. So I have different processes where an electron hops here and comes back, or an electron hops here and somebody else comes back. But it's obvious that whatever went to the double occupied site has to come back to the same site. So JK is equal to IJ. And now I have, these are called super exchange paths. So to complete the path, I have minus T over U to go from here to here using this operator. And then I have a minus T here to hop back. So overall, I have a T squared over U with a minus sign. Okay? So out of all these terms that I have here, let me just keep the ones that are non-zero. And they're going to be, so you see that I'm just going to be dealing with pairs of sites. So I have a sum over ij, nearest neighbors, and then I'm going to have ci, cj, and then I'm going to have cj, ci. This is going to be with spin S. This is going to be with spin S. This is going to be spin S. This is going to be spin S prime. These are the kind of terms that survive. And the overall coefficient is minus T squared over U. But there's going to be two of those terms. One of them is going to be this guy from K to J and then back. Or now I call it I and J. Actually, I shouldn't use ij. I shouldn't have used the same indices. Ij, and here I should use kl. Kl. Yeah, okay. So, but this process made sure that that KL is equal to IJ, or LK is equal to IJ. So I have two terms that look like this. So the other term is just going to be I goes to J. Same term, but I commute the indices. Okay, now I want to write this term, so I'm explicitly writing it. Every term like this could be written as C, and there's a sum over S and S prime. C, I up, C, J up, C, J up, C, I up, plus C, I up, C, J up, C, J down, C, I down. Dagger and dagger. And there's two more terms when I flip all the spins, plus C, I down, C, J down, C, J down, C, I down, up, up, and another one with C, I down, C, J down, C, J up, C, I up. Okay? And then the term I goes to J. So four of these terms written explicitly. Now, to make this nicer, I'll commute CJ up and CJ up. So that means that this is equal to 1 minus the opposite order. So it'll be CI up, CJ up, dagger, and then the CI up can be commuted with this two operators, because this is a two operator, so a fermion can go through since J and I anti-commute. So I can rewrite this term as actually CI up, CI up, and then CJ up, dagger CJ up with a minus sign. And here I'll have plus CI up, CI up. Okay, that's the first term. The second term, these two guys anti-commute and don't give me a 1 because they're opposite spins. So I'll write it as minus CI up, CI down, CJ up, CJ down. That's just commuting this guy to this guy and this guy with this guy. This doesn't give you a minus sign. This gives me a minus sign, so that's this minus sign. Third guy. Third guy is very similar to this guy because all the spins are the same direction except down now. So it'll give me minus C, minus CI up, CI, sorry, now it's CI down, CJ down, CJ down. And then there's a plus CJ, CI down, CI down, CI down, dagger, CI down. And I'm at the last term, which is C, again, minus sign, CI down, CI up, CJ up, CJ down. And that's the way I want to write it. So notice what it's written in a bit more concise way. This is just minus NI up, NJ up, this plus NI up, minus, this is nothing but S plus of I, and this is, there was a down up here. This is S minus of J. This guy is minus NI down, NJ down, plus NI down. And the last guy is S minus I S plus J. Okay, so I want to write it essentially as S dot S. S dot S, S I dot S J, can be written as half N I up minus N I down, N J up minus N J down. There's actually a quarter here. This is S Z S Z. And then there's a half of S plus S minus plus S minus S plus IJ. Just a simple way of writing SZ SZ, SX SX plus SY SY. So I already have the S plus S minus, and I have pieces of this guy, but not everything. I get the NI up up, and here I have down down, but I don't have the down up. So what I'm going to do is add another term to make it look like the Heisenberg model. So it's going to look like this. So first of all, this term here is going to look like Ni up plus Ni down is just Ni, right? So I have here Ni, and then I have minus and I'm going to write these two terms, up up plus down down, as a sum of SZI SZJ plus NI NJ. Now this is a factor of 4 here. So if I multiply that by 4, I'll get Ni up, Nj up, plus Ni down, Nj down, minus the cross term. If I look at Ni dot Nj, that's simply N up minus, plus N down, N up plus N down. So the cross terms will vanish when I add 4 times SZSZ to Ni Nj. So that the way to make sure that the cross terms vanish and give me this term, but this is a factor of 2, I need to divide by 2. Plus, and then I have S plus S minus plus S minus S plus. So again, to make it look like the Heisenberg model, I have Ni minus, this is essentially coming here with a factor of half. So I need to, if I want to divide by half or multiply by 2, I'll get essentially there's 2 and there's 2, so I get 2 times SI dot SJ minus NI and J divided by 2. Am I right? Okay. So this is the way you get the Heisenberg interaction out of this T squared over U. But I haven't finished. I just took one term here, this term here. This term here is the same, except that I replace I and j, but this is, everything stays the same, except now I have nj. So to conclude, I'll just write the total expression. So my effective Hamiltonian, H2, is going to be a sum over bonds. The coefficient now is going to be, there's a factor of 2 here in front of the Heisenberg model. So it's going to be a factor of 2 And there's two terms, one with ij and then the ji. So it'll be 4. So it's going to be 4 t squared over u. Notice that here I had a minus sign in front of the sisj. In front of the whole expression, I had a minus sign from the 1 over minus u. So the 2 minus sign give me a plus sign. That's very important. This is a positive number. This is si dot sj. This guy is called j. It's called the super exchange. We met it before when we did the two-site Hubbard model. But now it's on the lattice between all bonds I and j. And then there is a terms of order of the density. There's ni that appears here minus ni and j over 2. But now we can replace, because we're doing everything in a single subspace. So when you project it, ps turns all these n's to 1. Okay? So I have 1 minus a half. I have a half here. I have a half here, and I have another half when I do I goes to j, so I have 1, but here I multiply by 4, so this will give me minus a quarter. Now, why do I insist on having all these constants right? They don't really matter for any important physics. The Hamiltonian up to constants is what matters, but I want to make sure that I get the right two-site Hubbard model back. You remember that in the two-site Hubbard model, the energies were 0 for the 3 triplets, and they were minus 4 t squared over u for the singlet. So if I look at this expression in the triplet is simply a quarter, right? Because I get SZ, let's say if I take the 2 spins in the Z direction and I do SZ, SZ, and then I do up, up. I get a half from this guy, a half from this guy, and this is a quarter. So in this state, SZ, SZ, which is the only term that is diagonal between up, up, and up, up, is a quarter. So a quarter minus a quarter is 0. That's the reason the triplet is 0. So I fix the constant right, and the singlet is going to be at energy minus 4 t c over u, which is the essentially the super exchange minus j. And the splitting between singlet and triplet is precisely the super exchange coupling j. So this is the effective Hamiltonian that we get. It's the quantum Heisenberg model. And it's the, if you want, the hydrogen atom of many-body physics. It's the model where you can see most of the interesting effects of quantum mechanics, macroscopic phenomena, symmetry breaking, quantum disorder, all the important effects, fluctuations, Goldstone modes, Higgs phenomena, everything is in this model. Looks very, very simple, but difficult to solve. I'll explain why it's difficult to solve in spite of its simplicity. But this model is also a great tool that everybody who does many body, or I would say even today's people who do field theory and high energy physics, should be familiar with all the different approaches you could use to this model. There's asymptotic expansion, series expansions, quantum Monte Carlo, variational wave functions, large N, field theories, all the arsenal of techniques that researchers use these days were developed for this model and then applied to, you know, maybe more physically relevant systems. But in this system, you already see if a certain approximation works and why. We're not going to treat this model in a very, very extensive way. In my book, there's much more discussion of this model than I'm going to do here. I just want to use it for a completely different purpose than magnetism. I want to use it to understand superconductivity. But I just want you to appreciate the complexity of this model. Now, why is this model so difficult? There's a similar model, which you might have seen in statistical mechanics, or you're probably going to see in your statistical mechanics course very shortly, which is the Ising model. The Ising model, JZ, SZ, SZ, IJ, sum of IJ, is a much simpler model. It's a classical model. What do I mean by a quantum model and a classical model when things look like operators in both cases? This model, I know all its eigenstates immediately. All its eigenstates are states that are specified by direction of the Z spin in every site. Since SZ commutes between site I and site J, I can label just the local eigenstates of SZ and form this Ising basis. And describe, for instance, the partition function as the sum over all Ising configuration S1 to Sn, e to the minus beta. And here I can put the eigenenergies. The eigenenergies are simply given by sum over ij, j, and the small s, si, sj. These are numbers, not operators anymore. So now I have a partition function in terms of numbers. It's a much easier job than what you have to do with the Heisenberg model. For the Heisenberg model, it's not true that I can put numbers into this expression unless I'm doing some approximation. I can't change these operators by numbers because the eigenstates of Sx and Sy and Sz are not the same. Sx, Sy, and Sz don't commute. And I have all three operators with the same weight, so I can't prefer the z direction basis to the x and to the y. And what these terms do is they flip spins. So each one of these Ising states is just a configuration. And my wave functions are superpositions of 2 to the n of these guys for one eigenstate. So these are eigenstates of Ising model. But eigenstates of Heisenberg are some psi, which is superposition of all the Sn 1 to Sn eigenstates, coefficients S1 to Sn, and then you have the Ising basis. A many-body wave function, which is a superposition of many, many different Ising configurations, will give us just one single excitation of the Heisenberg model. And all because of the S plus, S minus terms that you have here. Right? The only difference in Ising and these guys are S plus, S minus terms, these guys. That's, of course, being prejudiced that the Z direction is special, which it's not. This model has SU2 symmetry. I can rotate my Z axis of direction of the Z spin. And since this is a scalar product, it's rotational invariant, the Hamiltonian is invariant. So it has extra symmetries the Ising model doesn't have, and has quantum numbers like total spin that the Ising model doesn't respect. And there's theorems about the nature of these coefficients for the ground state psi 0. And those theorems, I guess there's a Marshall theorem that's in my book. It's like a non-negativity theorem. There's theorems about degeneracies in this model in one dimension. And there's quite a lot of quantum mechanics goes into analyzing the spectrum and excitations of this model. So it's deceivingly simple to write, very complicated to solve. That's maybe the take-home message from all this discussion. Any questions? OK, so in this course, I'm not going to go very deeply into this model. It's not the purpose here. What I want to do actually is to start learning approximations. Because my main goal is essentially to get you to have tools where you look at the model, you don't know how to solve it, but you can say something clever about it without solving it. That's what approximations are for, okay? It's not to be, you know, approximations are, for physicists, more useful than exact solutions. I'm talking seriously. Mathematicians like exact solutions, or certain kinds of mathematical physicists like exact solutions, but with approximations, you have much more power because you can look at the Hamiltonian with a bit of perturbations and also say something smart about it. An approximation is easier to make intuitive, to make, if you want, connection between classical and quantum, to understand all kinds of hierarchies of energy scales and time scales. So learning approximations is very important. And the approximation that I want to teach here is how to treat this model in a variational basis, in a basis of states, which is not the Ising basis. It's not this 2 to the n basis, but in a basis that is a basis of spin-coherent states. So we have to learn about spin-coherent states. And that basis will allow us to immediately see a connection between the classical and the quantum model. Classical model, just to define, is when you take these operators and replace them by C number vectors. That's the classical Heisenberg model. Just arrows with dot product between them. Okay? And this is an operator. So you need to have states, you need to have a basis to change these operators into expectation values and then see the connection between classical and quantum. Questions? No? So I'll move forward. Okay, spin a half coherent states. There's also spin s coherent states, but I'm just talking about spin a half to make life simple. Coherent states are defined by two functions, or essentially by two angles, that define a vector on the unit sphere omega. So I have a unit sphere, okay? Here's my North Pole. Here's the perimeter institute, as far as in my resolution. Here is the, not actually here. This is my longitudes. This is my latitudes. Okay, so longitudes are phi, latitudes are theta, measured from the North Pole, not like in the map. And a vector, or unit length, omega, is specified by theta and phi, coordinate on the sphere. So omega is a function of theta and phi, but theta and phi live on the sphere, so therefore they're periodic. Phi goes between 0 and 2 pi, and theta goes between 0 and pi. And what is a coherent state? It's very simple. It's cos theta over 2 spin up plus sine theta over 2 e to the I phi spin down. It's a superposition of the two Ising states up and down. Okay? Those of you who remember their quantum mechanics, Stern-Gerlach, spin omega is essentially a spin polarized in the direction of a magnetic field pointing in the omega direction. And that's the eigenstate that you get from the unitary transformation on the z-axis or whatever method you want to use. diagonalizing the spin in the magnetic field or whatever. These two functions are very important functions in mathematics. They're called monopole harmonics. There's a whole mathematics literature about, or it's a whole discipline of using them to describe functions on the sphere. In fact, they were invented by navigators and geometers in the time where navigation was the most important science, and you can use them to do all kinds of calculations on the sphere, areas between great circles, and so on. Okay. Not relevant for this thing. Anyway, so now I want to describe expectation values. So what is the expectation value of Sz in omega? Okay, Sz measures half h bar for this guy, measures minus half bar for this guy, right? And then I multiply with the opposite direction, and it's a half h bar, and there's going to be a cosine squared theta over 2, and minus, for the minus here, sine squared theta over 2, which by my high school trigonometry, if I remember correctly, is cos theta. What is S plus? S plus is you take this spin and you flip it. This spin you can't flip because it's already up. So if you flip this spin, then this guy will have an overlap with cos theta over 2. So this is cos theta over 2, and there's a h bar, and there's a sine. I'm going to drop the h bar soon, so don't worry, but keep it now for fun for the spin operators. Anyways, sine theta over 2, e to the I, phi. So I want to write it in a way that looks like h bar divided by 2, sine theta, e to the I, phi. And S minus is just the complex conjugate, h bar over 2, sine theta, e to the minus I, phi. So Sx is h bar over 2, just a second, am I right? Yeah, Sx is S plus plus S minus divided by 2. So it's h bar over 2 sine theta cosine phi, and Sy, which is S plus minus S minus divided by 2i, is going to be h bar over 2 sine theta sine. So to summarize, S as a vector between omega, omega is h bar over 2 times the vector. Because what are the three components of omega? The three components in the z direction, it's cos theta. And in the x direction, it's sine theta cos phi, sine theta sine phi. So we see that if I put the operator S inside a coherent state, I will get the vector omega, three components, because this operator has three operators here, essentially. And then magnitude is h bar over 2. OK? Yeah. Yes. OK. So we can make progress. I can ask the question, what is S dot omega between omega and omega? S dot omega, well, this is just three Sx, Sy, Sz multiplied by the Dirac coefficients. So it's essentially going to be h bar over 2, omega dot omega, but omega is a unit vector, so it's 1. H bar over 2, OK? So if I ask, what is the spin component in the direction omega of this coherent state? It's as if I had a magnetic field, and I am polarized exactly in the direction of the magnetic field, and I get plus a half for this operator, OK? Another question I can ask is, what is the expectation value when you have two spin coherent states? So I'll define now two spin coherent states as omega 1, omega 2. It's essentially the product of omega 1 with omega 2. Because I have two spins, I can label them site 1 here and site 2 and write the tensor product. And I can calculate omega 1, omega 2, S dot S 1, 2. Omega 1, omega 2. Now, since this operator acts only on states that belong to, and this stats only on states belong to 1, it's a product of omega 1 S1 omega 1 dot omega 2 S2 omega 2. And now I know this is just omega 1 dot omega 2. And of course, h bar divided by 2 squared. Okay? So you see that the expectation value of the Heisenberg model in coherent states is simply the classical interaction between unit vectors. It has a magnitude h bar over 2 because that's the size of our spin, spin a half. Now, it's useful to use those spin coherent states as a basis and also as variational wave functions. Variational wave functions and bases are two important kinds of states that we need. Okay, I'll go over there. So, what more properties do I need? Do I need for the I need also to know a little bit about their orthogonality, because spin coherent states actually are defined with a continuum of parameters theta and phi for every site. Now, continuum sounds like a large infinity which describes a Hilbert space, if you want, that's actually size 2. So there's a lot of redundancy between infinity and 2. I have too many states, right? Coherent states are must be overcomplete. They must be non-orthogonal. And indeed, I can calculate their overlap and get what it is. And it's important to know the overlap. So I can ask, what is the overlap between a spin coherent state omega and omega prime? So if I write it explicitly, it's cos theta over 2 cos theta prime over 2 plus sine theta over 2 sine theta prime over 2 e to the minus I phi minus phi prime. That's an ugly looking expression. First of all, I'd like to know its magnitude, and then I want to know its phase. It's a complex expression. So first of all, you can immediately see it's not zero when omega and omega prime are not the same. Well, these numbers are finite, not necessarily vanish. So it's better to write it in this form. I'll write, first of all, omega dot omega prime absolute value squared. What is that? Well, it's the real part of this guy squared plus the imaginary part of this guy squared. So let me do some. So C, let me call this C and C prime. This is called S and S prime. So I'll have here C, C prime plus S, S prime. And then I have here the real part, so it's cos phi minus phi prime. That's the real part. Then there's imaginary part, which is just S, S prime. And here I'll have sine of phi prime minus phi. Okay. And that's the imaginary part. Take the square of this, square of this. And now I have to expand it. So C, C prime. It reminds me when I was called to the board in high school by my Polish teacher to do trigonometry. I wasn't very good. So C plus C prime, S prime cos theta. So I'll have this guy squared, this squared, and a cross term, 2 C C prime S S prime cos phi minus phi prime squared, okay? And then there'll be an S S prime squared sine squared phi minus phi prime. Okay, can this be simplified? Well, what one has to do is to identify, for instance, here, this is simply given in terms of 2. Cosine sine is essentially, these are sine of theta over 2. So cosine sine will be sine of theta, right, divided by 2. And this will be sine of theta prime divided by 2. Cosine squared of theta over 2, so cosine squared of theta over 2 is equal to 1 minus cos theta divided by 2. Am I right? Or is it plus? I think it's right. So cosine squared is plus, sorry. And sine squared of theta over 2 is 1 minus cos theta over 2, right? Am I right? So all I have to do is replace these guys, cosine squared and sine squared and cosine prime and sine prime, by these expressions. So I'll have here 1 plus cos theta over 2, 1 plus cos theta prime over 2. And then I'll have plus 1 minus cos theta over 2, 1 minus cosine theta prime over 2, and cos squared phi minus phi prime. Okay. And here I also have, yes. Right, exactly. That's exactly right. You're sitting more in the back, you can see the algebra better. There are two terms that add up to 1. So I'll eliminate them. So I don't need this term. So I have here 1 minus cos theta, 1 minus cos theta prime over 2. Okay? Am I doing fine? Don't need this side algebra. Okay. So this guy is multiplied by cos phi minus phi prime. And also, there's a factor of 2 here. So I have 3 terms, this guy, this guy, and this guy. Now, here I have cross terms that will cancel the cross terms here. So what I'm left with is I get a half, a half. I get a half, a half. So I get a quarter plus a quarter, which is a half. And then I get cos theta prime, cos theta prime, which is cos theta prime. There's a factor of a quarter and a quarter, which is another half. So that's this guy, plus. And then I have here 2 times a quarter, which is a half, times sine theta prime, cos phi minus phi prime. Okay? Now this is simply a half times 1 plus, this is just omega dot omega prime, two vectors, unit vectors, scalar product. That's all it is. So that's the result. This is equal to the overlap of omega and omega prime squared, absolute value squared. Very important for people who do quantum information. Right? They do all kinds of Stern-Gerlach experiments and overlaps of measurement of one axis and another axis and Bell's inequalities. This comes in all the time, this expression. So what you learn from this expression is omega and omega prime are not orthogonal, but they could be orthogonal. When are they orthogonal? When omega and omega prime are exactly opposite to each other, then it gives me a minus 1 and they're orthogonal. But otherwise, they're not orthogonal. Okay. But there's another important part of this overlap calculation, which is a phase. That phase is very important. It's called the Berry phase. So omega dot omega prime is equal to 1 plus omega dot omega prime divided by 2 square root. That's just square root of this expression. E to the I upsilon. Upsilon is the phase of this ugly expression. So it's the ratio of the imaginary to the real, and you take arctangents. So this is arctangents of this expression. Sine theta over 2. Sine theta prime over 2. Sine phi minus phi prime divided by the real part, which is cosine theta over 2, cosine theta prime over 2, plus sine theta over 2, sine theta prime over 2, cosine phi minus phi prime. Okay? That's the expression of the phase. So let us now look at what is the expression of the phase if omega and omega prime are very close. This is omega and this is omega prime. And this angle here is very small. That means that delta theta is small and delta phi is small. Then I can approximate this as follows. If theta is very close to theta prime, the leading order here is just sine squared theta over 2, which is the average between theta and theta prime, plus a small correction. But the leading order is this guy. The leading order in sine phi minus phi prime is the error, is the difference. And sine of a small number is equal to the small number. So this is going to be phi minus phi prime divided by, these two numbers are very close to each other, so I'll write cos squared theta over 2. These two are sine squared theta over 2, and cosine of a small number is very close to 1. So if I want the whole Berry phase, it's arctangents of this guy, because I'm approximating this to be 1 plus order delta omega, and this is of order delta omega. So I have to keep the leading order term, and I don't have to keep the next order term to 1. Arctangents of a small number of order delta number is exactly like sine and tangents and all these odd functions. It's essentially equal to this small number. So I can forget the arctangents, and I'll get that this is essentially 1 minus cosine theta delta phi with a factor of a half in front, very important. And I was expecting this year's Nobel Prize to go for this calculation, to Berry. What? Ah, you can't see, okay. So I'll raise the board. And I won't write there anymore. Okay, so you see that I calculated for you the small phase difference between two coherent states that are very close. Yeah. I changed the order and changed the sign somewhere. Let's see. Because there I had phi minus phi prime with a minus sign. But what I wanted is phi prime minus. Yeah, I guess this will be phi prime minus phi. Yeah, so it's phi prime minus phi everywhere. This is the right sign. Okay? So just to explain why this phase is so important. This phase is the only thing that changes infinitesimally when you change the state. And we learn soon, when I define the path integral of coherent states, that plays a very important role in the path integral. So if you take two states, omega and omega prime, which is omega plus delta omega, and I'm taking delta omega to be very, very small, this is to leading order e to the I 1 minus cos theta divided times a half, and then there's delta phi. Now, one can ask, is that the only phase one can write? And of course, the answer is no. Why? Because when I define a state in Hilbert space, you know that I can define a state up to a phase only. So every omega could be multiplied by an arbitrary e to the I chi, and I'll still have the same physical state. So knowing which state, which is the right phase to state, is impossible in physics. All I can say is relative phases, and even then, I can add some arbitrary number to relative phases, because I can multiply this guy with a different phase, and I multiply this guy, and then I'll have here plus an arbitrary delta chi. So this infinitesimal expression has no meaning unless we're describing eventually products of many of these overlaps on a closed loop. But we'll get to that later. I just mention it now. This is called gauge invariant quantities, like loop products, products of, if you want, omega 1 times omega 2, omega 2 times omega 3, omega 3 times omega 4, and eventually coming back from omega n to omega 1. This is a loop because it has points on the sphere representing the coherent states, and I'm calculating the product. And then all these grad phi will drop out. So that's something. So the Berry phase is defined up to some arbitrary function who is essentially a gradient and is not important for loop integrals. But now we just have the definition. Now, one can realize immediately from looking at it that something is not invariant in this expression. I have a special role for theta and a different role for phi. And one can ask, but just a minute, the choice of latitude and longitude is completely arbitrary. Who said the North Pole has to be here, right? So C.N. Yang actually gave a lecture once, and he explained why the North Pole is where it is. And his argument was, no country wants a singularity in their map, in their territory. So that's why they pushed it to the North Pole. But I think it's the correct expression. OK, so the North Pole is defined here, but for spins, you can define it anywhere else, and then theta and phi will change. This expression looks like it changes, but as I said, for gauge invariant quantities, eventually, it won't matter. And we could use this particular convention. It's like fixing a gauge, if you want, to describe the Berry phase. Okay, so now I've described essentially the properties of overlaps. And the last thing, I don't know if I have time. Don't have time. 3 minutes. Okay, so I won't keep you. I'll just say what I'm going to do next lecture. I'm going to show that with coherent states, I can expand the whole Hilbert space. So it's true that the coherent states are too many. But one can say maybe there are too many coherent states, but they don't span all the spin states. Or maybe I cannot use them to write the identity. You know, if you want to write resolution of identity sum over n and n, the question is, can you write the identity as some integral d omega on the sphere, omega, omega? Because if yes, this becomes a very useful tool to describe Hamiltonians. Once you have a resolution of identity, you can use the representation, this particular coherent state representation, to write the Heisenberg model and its dynamics and essentially all its properties in this basis. And that's what we're going to do next time. So. No condensed matter today.